You're listening to the Arctic Circle podcast. In this episode, we listen to five experts discuss collaboration across borders and boundaries. The experts are Ashok Kumar Bianyu Shrestha, Mayor of Dhulikhel, Nepal, Madeline Redfern, COO of Can Arctic Inuit Networks and Northern Director of Arctic 360, Iqaluit Nunavut, Canada, Crawford Patkutak, Chairman of the Board of the Arctic Regional Slope Corporation, United States, David W. Lan, Deputy Director of the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, United States, and Mead Treadwell, Chair of U.S. Arctic Research Commission, 2006 to 2010, Lieutenant Governor of Alaska in 2010 to 2014, Chairman CEO of Kielak LNG, and Board Member of PT Capital. The panel is followed by a Q&A with the audience, moderated by Omair Ahmad, Managing Editor for South Asia, the Third Pole in India, and Catherine Friedman, North American Arctic Policy Advisor at the Tad Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies in the United States. This event originally took place at the 2023 Arctic Circle Abu Dhabi Forum and was organized by the Tad Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies.
Dear delegates and the participants of this 2023 Arctic Abu Dhabi Forum, warm welcome, warm greeting to the all. I would like to express my thanks to the organizer for providing this opportunity. I am very grateful to invite to this program and able to present Nepal, especially my city Dhulikhel, in this subject. I am sure that this forum will share the thought of the concerned authorities about the observed environment impact in the world. Certainly, the interest related to the situation has been seen as the performance interest of the world and it has seen the need to be proactive to minimize it. Due to the observed environmental effect, we are facing many problems like uncertainty, temperature rise and fall, inappropriate weather conditions, irregular rainfall, negative impact in the agriculture, and so on. This problem has been seen almost all over the world as well. So we have to be more concerned to minimize it by joint hand and collaboration with each other. If it continues according to the this world will be have a deal with a big famine in the future, especially in hunger. Even in Nepal, there is a situation where adverse environmental effect has started to be seen. Some of the example here irregular snow melting in large proportion, heavy rain, territorial rain of the on rain according water resources and during of the so on. Therefore, Nepal and local government of here are taking necessary steps as such as much as possible to mitigate these challenges. As regarding Dhulikhel, the city is observing various activities to keep environment clean and greenery. The city has given special priority to make a city green city, priority proper sewerage, waste and drainage management, water security, as we have a community-based drinking water supply project, which is the one of the first practiced in Nepal. Like this, we have periodically conducted several tree plantation camping in the city of this year. we completed planning around 100,000 sampling. The city has built more than 50 parks to enjoy a peaceful, green and sound environment. The city already completed Pani Chautari and Water Conference to identify, manage and protecting water resources. With the aim to preserve water resources and also reviving the water by means of rainwater harvesting, Dhurikhel also worked with SIAS, South Asian Institute of Advanced Studies. City has made disabled friendly trail act and progressing mechanism for the disaster risk management. Beside this, municipality taken higher priority of indigenous people. Beside bicycle, municipality has been five different councils empower and development themselves entrepreneurship. Those five council are youth, women, Dalit council, engineers, and the disabled. The municipality has been providing similar skill development training to the people under the respective councils. This will help them to the uplift their life and therefore poverty reduction. It has providing equal opportunity to people of all communities to grow up, including engineers. Recently, city has conducting its voluntary local review of SDG 1, SDG 2, SDG 3, SDG 4, and SDG 6, which is first practicing in Nepal and with South Asia as well. The city already committed to the carbon emission to zero by 2030 in order to minimize vehicle fuel consumption rate and also smoke emission by vehicles in the collaborating with Kathmandu University. Already, city already conducting project on hydrogen fuel-based vehicle, and this project is at the final stage of and will be launching soon. In additional, the government of Nepal has given priority to electric vehicle by discourage petrol-powered vehicle. Lastly, Nepal government and local government of Nepal are taking high concern to minimize this hazard issue to overcome from this situation on one city, and government also along in enough and will need to move forward unitedly, and Dhurikhel will have full commitment for this. In this regard, it is the possible vibe to coordinate and conduct research with all stakeholders and communities, as well as it is the more essential to cooperate. Cooperation, coordination, and manage investment to overcome from this issue. Integrating with global to local community from the entire world. Thank you.
You know, right here we have someone on the ground, a local official, coming to this forum, building relationships, sharing best practice, and, you know, sharing information on his municipality's successful water project. So it's just great to have you here. Thank you so much. Thank you. Madeline, do you want to give us, you know, your perspective?
Having been a former mayor, I totally understand what you're going through and how you are the government closest to the people, and how important it is to deal with the real issues, you know, facing your community members' needs with respect to water, transportation, energy, you know, and the value and the need to work with your different stakeholders at the community level, at different governments, with the private sector to find those solutions and those investments. And I know that my time as mayor is the value of being able to go to, you know, events that are at the regional, national, and international level are incredibly important, because it is that opportunity to, you know, learn from each other, share what is happening in your region and your community to influence policies. You know, sometimes it's interesting because you're trying to influence it from the bottom up. You're trying to influence it from the top down. You're trying to influence from the side. And it takes a lot of tenacity and patience to achieve, at the end of the day, you know, that advocacy that translates into securing the projects, you know, in your communities or in your region. There's been immense value, especially with Arctic Circle and other type of polar or Arctic regional exchanges, is being able to see what's happening in Greenland or in the Nordic countries or in Alaska, and be able to draw upon that network and that those examples to be able to advocate, you know, for my own sort of region and my own community to the government of Canada, and saying, you know, look at what's happening in Greenland and how further advanced they are in the investment, strategic investments in telecommunications, building out 2 fiber optic cables, how strategic they are in their energy sector. They're on their 6th hydro dam, or even in Alaska, where they did a macro micro assessment of what the energy solutions are or options, and sort of what could work not only for that particular community, but what, you know, nearby communities, what are the geo or environmental considerations, because you can't really do a hydro dam if you don't have a significant river or lake to dam, if your region's really flat, if you don't have a lot of sunlight, enough of it year round, then that's not necessarily a, you know, a particularly good base load solution. So being able to sort of, you know, have these exchanges, because so often in our Arctic regions, what we've seen is a very southern focused approach. So whether it's the third pole, you know, and learning and seeing that their issues are so similar to our northern pole issues, and being able to sort of say, you know, how bringing the third pole into the Arctic Circle, we can actually help advocate for the realities and the needs for whether it's scientific or whether it is the research and development and innovation solutions. And they may have, you know, equally different perspectives that we can learn from. So when you ask that question, you know, what have, you know, we personally learned is that the more you get out there, the more you learn, the more you share, the more you can influence policy and programs, and the more ability you might be able to be successful in getting the resources that you ultimately need at your community and regional level.
That's great. That's great, Madeline. Thank you. And again, what I heard some key words in your brief talk. I heard getting out there and the importance of exchange and networking and advocacy. And I think that those are some really key takeaways for folks who are at the subnational level, who may feel like they don't have that voice in traditional multilateral forums, to really get out there. And then it also demonstrates again the importance of, this is another plug for a forum like the Arctic Circle, providing people the opportunity to engage and network and exchange. So that's terrific. Thank you. David.
Yes, I'm Mr. David Lamb. I'm a historian by trade. So I had a historian professor looking at the economics and political science professor out here. He told me one day that economics was the study of who has what, and political science was the study of who's going to decide who has what. So I always kept that in the back of my head. I thought as a historian I would give you a little context about the regional centers. You've heard about the Arctic Center, which was formed starting last year. The Department of Defense has five regional centers that cover down on regional geography. We have the George Marshall Center in Garmisch, Germany, which is assigned to the European Command footprint. We have the Asia Pacific Center in Honolulu. That's a real hardship tour for those folks out there. They're in Honolulu, and they deal with the greater Pacific and area. We have co-located at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. We have the Perry Center, William Perry Center, which is responsible for the Americas, North America, and arbitrating now Arctic issues with them. And then the Africa Center for Strategic Studies is co-located with us at the National Defense University. They're all founded for different reasons. I will tell you why the NISA Center was founded. It was founded in 1990 when the Track 1 talks, government-to-government talks between Israel and Palestine broke down. And they did not want the dialogue to stop completely. So they formed the regional center, the Near East South Asia Center, to re-engage with the Israelis, Palestinians, and work on a peace process. So you can't just blow in as a DOD organization and begin to do that. So we worked and developed a Track 2 system to do all of that. For that leads us to today. But in those days, to re-engage the Palestinian Israelis, we worked with the University of California at Los Angeles. They run two conferences a year in Prague under the auspices of a subgroup at UCLA called the Center for Middle East Development. We fund half of that effort. The Department of Defense funds half of that effort. It brings about 300 people from the region together, youth, publishers, whole of government folks, and that's where we began to restart the dialogue with the Middle East. As things progressed over the years, we began working with the International Security Studies Group called IISS out of London, and we co-sponsor a number of their events, the Manama Dialogue. We bring together the security heads of the Indian security services and the Pakistani security services with our head of intelligence once a year in Oman, very quietly, and that's how we get about doing that. A number of years ago, when Iran and the nuclear deal came up, we were asked to participate in building a matrix of confidence-building measures that led to the JCPOA. And we did that with a think tank out of Ottawa, Canada, and it's run out of the University of Ottawa. And they do great work there, and it allowed us, through a site license with our Department of Treasury, to be able to talk to the only agency in the U.S. government. We get to talk to Iranian officials and academics directly in that forum. So that's the kind of the work we do. And I would say, as you said, Mr. President, when the government-to-government talks muddle out and begin to fizzle and fall apart, you've got to find a way to keep talking. You just must find a way to keep talking. At the height of the Cold War, okay, when I jumped into Grenada and seized the Soviet embassy with 30 of my paratroopers, while all that was going on, the Soviet Union and the Americans were still talking, okay? So you've got to continue. And my experience is that most of this, even after 30 years in the military, the last 17 years at the Near East South Asia Center, we have about 40 people there, and they're engaged in this work all around the world in our footprint. But it goes from Bangladesh to Marrakesh, okay? It's kind of the whole swath. So we have over 10,000 alumni, approaching 12,000 alumni now. We've either come to our courses, two-week courses in the United States, seminars that are security, regional security centered, or we have export programs. In the last 10 years, we founded the National Defense College here for the United Arab Emirates. We did that here in Abu Dhabi in 2006. And I will be off tomorrow, off to Riyadh, where we're standing up the Saudi Arabian National Defense University. And that acronym is SANDU, and it just happened to work out that way, okay? So, a few things about the Middle East. We've put together, I talked about Iran, but the Palestinians, Jordanian, Israelis have negotiated over water rights in the Jordan River. Two alumni from the NISA Center who were there at the center together went on, rose high in government, and did that deal together. A number of years ago, when the Pakistan attacked a hotel in Mumbai, if you remember that tragic event, we worked with our think tank, the Hoover Center at the University of Stanford, to bring together high-ranking former general officers from the Pakistani Strategic Forces and the Indian Strategic Forces to kind of cool that situation down. As you remember, the Indians were going to do cold start, which meant next time it happens, the policy was going to be, we're going to race in your territory and seize territory, which the Pakistanis responded with, if you do that, we're going to deploy tactical nuclear weapons around the countryside. We were able to bring those two together and tell the Indians, you have no capability to do a cold start, so you shouldn't have said it. And Pakistan, we tried tactical nuclear weapons in Europe in the 1960s, and you just don't want to go down that road. And then getting them together, talking through that, it de-escalated a number of situations between India and Pakistan. But now, an offering. In 1984, India, one day before Pakistan was able to do it, seized the glacier, okay? The one we were talking about all week, the Sachin Glacier. In America, we have a saying, what is the dog going to do when it catches the car? So the dog ran down the street, caught the car. You're up on the glacier. I have many friends who wear the triangle patch on their uniforms who will tell you off the record that from a military perspective, that was the dog catching the car. The operation at the top of the world, the world's highest battlefield, is taking up nearly 3,000 Indian troops. It's a major logistical effort, if you call it a logistical effort. It is actually a logistical disaster from day to day. Troops move up to base camp, remain there to acclimatize, and then have to haul all their equipment up another almost 2 week walk up onto the 100 positions along the glacier, where they proceed, like most soldiers do, to leave trash litter, nearly a ton of trash each day, which now the Indian government, clean Sachin, green Sachin, is now flying it back in aircraft. This is expensive when you're flying trash off a glacier, up and down, up and down. So I think a number of years ago, both parties wanted to get out of this and declare to the west, of course, is a park, to the east is a park, national park in the middle, that would be wonderful. But I think the major strategic issue now is China to the north, and the firm demarcation line that has to be recognized. But I think with a little attract to work, we could get those parties back together and try to work something out. And I'm sure my friends in the Pakistani military would hail me forever if they didn't have to march up to 23,000 feet and sit in guard posts, little fiberglass shelters with five guys in them at a time. I think the Indians every other day have a casualty of some sort up there, mostly because of the climate. And so there are many track two solutions to get those done. I would offer IISS, which has a long relationship with Pakistan and India, and we could see what we may be able to do to sort this out, because it's an intractable position right now. And I know the Indians aren't really enamored with the military situation at the top of the world there.
All right. Thank you, David. Thank you. And that's a great offer. That's a great offer for folks in the audience to consider. Mead, you've had considerable experience, public sector, private sector, non-NGO leadership.
Hello. Yeah. Well, first off, it's a pleasure to sit on this panel with two mayors. My dad was a mayor of a small town called Newtown, Connecticut, that nobody ever heard of until a lot of kids were shot there where I went to school. But all I can say is that the job of mayor is actually just knowing what my father lived through. Your phone rings at 2 a.m. if the snow isn't plowed, if somebody's having a baby, if the fire department isn't moving fast enough. As a governor, I can tell you I got more sleep than my father did. So leave it at that. There were three other Alaskans who wanted to be here today who were going to be on that panel. One of them is listed up there, Crawford Pakatak. And Crawford couldn't be here because Oliver Levitt, who was one of the first Alaska Native leaders to help form Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, served with the Arctic Research Commission, a very, very active leader, passed away, and Crawford couldn't be there. And the other thing is that the Republicans and the Democrats in our state house cannot agree on who will be the speaker, so Crawford's son was again made the placeholder speaker. Crawford's not here. And Matt Hickey, who's at the Stevens Center with Catherine, and Craig Fleener, whose name was mentioned, who I had to serve with in state government, both wanted to be here and asked me to join this panel in their stead. Let me just say that some of the most fun accomplishments I've seen in the Arctic have come because the national level reached out to the local level to get something done. During the Clinton administration, we were in a situation where all of us had great hopes that we could help bring the newly opened former Soviet Union into the family of nations a lot of different ways. So the government of Alberta supported the Northern Forum tremendously. We had governors doing seminars. We had USAID gave a lot of money to the University of Alaska, and we had more Russian students in Alaska than all U.S. universities put together. Which means we now have many more Russian grandchildren in Alaska than many other parts of the United States put together, but it's actually a very important thing now. But USAID gave Crawford Pakatak, is also chairman of the North Slope Whaling Commission, Arctic Eskimo Whaling Commission, and the Arctic, the natives of the North Slope took USAID money and went over to teach their Russian brethren, in some cases their cousins, how to get back into subsistence whaling. Now, what was amazing about that is that every time we negotiated a quota for our subsistence whaling to continue a practice which had been around for 10,000 years, Russia voted against the North Slope natives. Until USAID got a Russian local interest involved, and all of a sudden Russia was voting with us at the IWC. We then had a different problem, which is Japan, which is a very close friend of Alaska, then voted against Alaska at the IWC and said, we're indigenous to our islands, why can't we go whaling while you go whaling? And I got a call from, then it changed from the Clinton to the Bush administration, and I got a call from a former assistant of mine who was at the National Security Council, and he said, I have no adult supervision down at NOAA. There's no sympathy for Japan's side. And unless we have a face-saving discussion on this, we will never resolve this issue. And so there was going to be no subsistence whaling under international law. And Governor Hickel and I wrote a piece for the newspaper that said, the Japanese have a point. This is not saving the whales to save the whales. It's saving the whales to raise the numbers. And let's work on that. And as a result, we sent that thing to the White House. The White House called in the ambassador and Japan back down and helped the people of the North Slope. And what's very interesting is that that diplomacy couldn't just work out between embassies in Washington and Tokyo. It had to work out with the participation of the locals, likewise as it did with the whaling there. I will say that there never would have been a response to the Komi oil spill, which was the first big oil spill after the Arctic opened, had there not been, again, state-to-state discussion between the governors. I got a phone call from the State Department saying, you know, we have all sorts of satellites that give us a picture, but we know nobody on the ground. And I said, well, we know lots of people on the ground. And the governor took my team to this oil spill, and we mustered it was one of the first things of the Arctic protection strategy. We mustered a response to this oil spill. And so I look at Arctic cooperation today as it's very, very important that we have the Arctic Council. I think it's very important that we get the Northern Forum back going. I think it's very important that we have, and I missed this yesterday, Madeline, support for ICC and the International Union on Circumpolar Health, which was also a precursor to this. We would be much better off if we had something like the Barents Council in the Bering region. And the reason why I say that is because at the Barents Council, when Syrian refugees are riding bicycles across the Norwegian border, it helps that the mayors have a relationship as well as the county governors as well as the national governments. And it's very important to keep those things going. The last story I'll tell just very quickly was that this can mean life or death in many different instances. Because of relationships between governors long before the national governments got into it, our burn center at our hospital became the go-to burn center for the Russians, nearest by. And we've done many, many things because of our proximity, because of neighbor-to-neighbor relations that have saved lives. And there's one particular life I lost. We had held a seminar at the Northern Forum for governors in the North to talk about local management of natural resources. And Governor Svetkov from Magadan, who I had known before through business, came to the final dinner at my house, and he said, Mead, this has been very, very helpful. We see how Alaska got some control of its wildlife and control of its oil and gas resources and control of its fish. And I'm going to Moscow next week based on this seminar to try to get a better piece of the quota for the fish in the Sea of Okhotsk. And that's the last time I saw my friend, the governor, because the mafia shot him in cold blood, and his picture was on the front page of every paper in the world because he was going to stand up for the locals. So watch out for that. But the fact is that because we had and did and continue to develop these person-to-person relationships, we can get problems solved at the local level sometimes, and sometimes when the national level just can't figure it out, we've got ways to help figure it out.
Thank you, Mead. Thank you for telling us about your experience through story. It was very, very powerful. And as you were talking, you made me think of an old maxim, Tip O'Neill, right? Former Speaker of the House in the United States, who said all politics is local. And I submit, perhaps all, maybe not all international diplomacy or international affairs is local, but I think the panelists have demonstrated that a big chunk of it is local and critically important. So with that, I'll turn the mic over to my colleague Omer to ask the panelists some follow-up questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've had some great interventions and we have a huge list of questions, so I'm gonna play this around a little with your because we also want you guys to be able to raise questions to the panel. And I was reminded with your story, Mead, because in my past life I oversaw this India-Pakistan peace building measures in Kashmir and everything else, And, you know, you have those usual talks with the generals and this and the spies and the, and, you know, the politicians. The area where we got the most work done in reality was with women civil society leaders. Because it needs to be real, and they knew the value of what was happening to their particular societies, and they could speak to each other as humans. So, in, I think I forget the year, in 2013, we got a group of women civil society leaders to cross the LOC. It's the only, permission I know in history that's happened. And these are not all of them are indigenously Kashmiri, but this is not family thing, with both the Indian government and the Pakistani government. So we needed to get in a lot and lot of buy-in. But, you know, they had troops on the other side of the mountain to just or on the thing. But I'd like to flip this question around that we keep talking about. With great respect to the president, it's not just about the ice melting. It's about the value we have for those particular environments. Iceland is beautiful for its particular culture that comes out of its particular geography. The same with every single geographical space that mayors or others represent. We are products of a particular place. Our values emerge out of that. Our relationships emerge out of that. One of the great things about Thulakail, which is one of the better-run municipalities in pretty much all of the Third Pole region, is that it was an early adopter of very smart water management systems with local village buy-in. And as Madeline and I were discussing yesterday, instead of this conversation about melting glaciers, about the tragedies that we have, why don't we talk about hope? And what are the good things that work out of it? And what I would like to ask each one of these panelists, and I'm going to plug it on Madeline first, is what's your one example of something that has emerged out of your own experience in your case, Canada, that has helped people transcend this municipal to high government thing? You know, what has worked that has worked well at the bottom level and has been appreciated beyond borders, if there is such a thing? Madeline, then maybe Ashokji, if you've got an example of something that's worked for you in Thulakail that's also that political leadership has appreciated. David, me? Yeah.
So I actually failed to do what I should have done, which is earlier, is the power of stories. Because speaking just statistics, you know, or in vague sort of terms, doesn't allow others to connect. I remember when I had the federal minister come to town and his staff wanted to arrange a meeting. You know, and I was like, that's fine, but can we do it in the car? I want to show the minister, you know, my community and the things that we were struggling with. And the staff really pushed back. We don't have time for that. No, it'll be the same amount of time, but we will do the meeting in the car. And the federal government had actually, with the territorial government, approved a $300 million airport, but the 3 kilometers from the airport to downtown was unpaved and was just a disaster with respect to the potholes. Like, it was breaking down our municipal and our residents and our commercial vehicles. And so, you know, so the minister's in the car and I'm trying to talk as I'm driving along and saying, Minister, this road would cost $3 million, only 1% of the cost of the airport to pay. Guess what? We got the $3 million. But that was not just sort of something that was good for our municipality, but to actually teach that to other municipal leaders. is that the way in which you have to tell, and ideally, you know, if you can convince those decision makers to come to your community so that they can experience it firsthand. So when we have federal ministers that would come off the plane and their assistants, and the very first complaint they had is, well, I was about to swear. I do that sometimes. But literally was like, what the? Because they couldn't actually use their cell phone. You couldn't download, you know, their emails, or an assistant, you know, who had been silly enough coming up from Ottawa and had saved the minister's presentation on the cloud, had no concept that, you know, they should have brought a hard copy. They should have saved it to the minister's laptop. So the power of stories is actually where you have the greatest influence. And it's what other decision makers, whether they're the bureaucrats or whether they're another level of politicians, it's what they remember. And it ultimately usually influences, you know, policy. They retell that story over, and then the next person tells it, and the next person tells it, and then eventually you've got that sort of like, you know, synergy and or collective mindset, like, oh, we need to do something. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that we've seen with respect to, you know, the issue, as the president said, you know, it can't just be about the ice. I know that one of my community members, Sheila Wakuche, who's very well known internationally, she's like, no, we have to put a human dimension to the Arctic. Because without that human dimension, we're not having other people connect with that. They don't understand, you know, why would we save ice? But when you realize that, you know, how that ice is integral in impacting not only the people of the, you know, who live in that region, but effectively making them realize that it impacts them. And that's why they need to care. That's why they need to act. And so that is what I would say is, you know, I had learned, and it's really, really something that a lot of people are now starting to realize is, don't talk at this level and statistics. It's rare that anyone's going to remember any of that.
Excellent. Any good example of something that's worked from the
Thank
field
you.
That other people have?
First of all, I want to share one thing. In Nepal, after promulgating, we have one new constitution. And constitution have creating the three types of government, federal, provincial, and local government.
This happened in 2015.
Yeah. But now, local government is very powerful and autonomous also. Still now, we have exclusive right, 21 exclusive right, especially disaster management, drinking water, small hydropower project, alternative energy, environment protection, and biodiversity. Biodiversity, protection of the water bodies, wild animal means and minerals. That is the big thing of the Nepalese development. Before that right is already our federal government they have. And then now it is the local government have too much opportunity to work together with this sector. And then we have some municipalities, municipality government, local government have creating new act, policy, and activities also. That is the new thing. I requested all of the international community, if you want to work together our local government, it is possible to the local government have worked together with this sector. As much as we need to collaborating local government through environment related and climate related action. That is the one thing. It is the very good opportunity from our local government to provide our constitution. And then especially Dulikhel municipality is the one of the municipality. My municipality not bigger, just 140,000 people inhabitant. But now we have lot of. This is my third term mayorship. before I'm deputy mayor and mayor, and then recently 1 year back I'm re-elected in the mayor. And then 5 years, I am working together with international communities and the municipal government and federal and provincial government, and as well as international NGO and local CBOs also. Then we are declaring 100% educated city, literacy city, ODF, 100% toilet and electricity providing the people. And one tap, one water drinking project, I am starting when we have 38% have people have one tap, one house. Now, 86% people have drinking water, safe drinking water. And now, just that time, we have 12 kilometer roads. But now we managing the 43 kilometer roads still now. And then I am declaring the child friendly city. That is the big thing from the local government to achieve that. And we already I am mentioning the 5 times of the council, engineers council, women council, youth council, lower caste council and the disabled council. That is the 5 councils working together with municipality and especially empowerment, skill development and entrepreneurship. That is the big thing, because when I was elected mayor, that time 30% people is below poverty. But now we increasing our people, economical and skill development and so many things, now 4.36% that are below poverty. That is the big thing.
And was this recognized by other municipalities? Have other
little bit other municipality is recognized. But this is not my individual declaration. Voluntary review report. UNISCAP also 1 year they are studying my city. Then after they declaring SDG related, 4 SDG related is the properly educating not only Nepal, it is the South Asian first city of the Dhulikhel is declaring the SDG related 4 action. That is the big thing.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Any successes? Just a good story. A yard.
Very, very quickly. It's in 2004 in the fall. I was the chief of staff for all the forces in Afghanistan. I had two great bosses. Zalmay Khalilzad was the ambassador, and Lieutenant General Barno was my direct boss, and I was the chief of staff. For months, we had come to recognize that for the military, the main effort in Afghanistan was the completion of a free and fair election, which would be certified by the United Nations. Now, so for months, we had been supporting Jean Arnault and his group, securing voter training workers, providing computers, IT equipment to their headquarters so they could monitor the election. The UN had none of that money. If you're an NGO and you really want to live high off the hog, you want to attach yourself to the U.S. military in a time of war. 95% of the resources in Afghanistan was the budget for the forward command. So this went on for a while as we supported the UN. And one of my staff came walking in one day. In fact, it was my lawyer. And this is from your story about working government bureaucracies and what you may need to do. Because technically, the way I was supposed to get equipment and funding to the UN was to go outside DOD, all the way up to the State Department, over to the UN, back down and back down. By that time, the election would have been over and it would have been a disaster. So we didn't do that. I just kept feeding the animal over there. And my lawyer walked in and said, sir, you have to stop. I got a note from here from the general counsel up in the Defense Department, and he says, cease and desist. So I said, well, okay. I took the note and I said, that's what you think this says. What I think this says is this. So I wrote on there, on the backside, to Doug Feith, who was the policy wonk up in the Pentagon at the time, and I said, if you tell me to cease and desist, there's going to be no free and fair election at the end of this month. I threw it on the fax machine, sent it in. It came back about 15 minutes later. Mr. Feith's little hand signature said, just keep doing what you're doing. Now, he was busy with Iraq, or he had big distractions. It wasn't going well. He said, just keep doing what you're doing. I will take care of the funding process with the UN. Now, I didn't think he would do it at all, but it really didn't matter. I had my get out of jail free card. The UN could go in. And if you remember that first election, it was a remarkable election. Very little violence, and it went very, very well. So, whenever you can, avoid running things all the way up the tape in governments, or because there's just bureaucracy there and 1,000 people to tell you no.
I love that story, and the Doug Feith footnote to your missile defense story, Mr. President. We'll do that one later. Hey, we got missile defense. I want to say, because we've just heard from a major military center, this is something the United States does that I'm not sure everybody understands. The six regional centers that you've talked about are, as Catherine put it yesterday, soft power. Okay, and it's to bring people together and build relationships. And Pima and I were having a conversation before, and I said, "What are you doing with Indo-PACCOM?" And he said, well, that's much bigger than we are. It's not. I have been to U.S. national security meetings for well over a decade now, pretty much two decades now, where the crossroads between climate and national security is huge. And you have a huge and big story here. And if you're not coming to the United States and stopping at Indo-PACCOM in Hawaii, you should. And you can rely on his center, but you should also rely on the Asian Pacific Center. And likewise, most people don't know this, but almost every nation on Earth besides outside the United States that is in our friend group has a military-to-military relationship, not just with the Pentagon, but also with the state National Guard. When I was lieutenant governor, our National Guard chief was also in charge of providing all aid to Mongolia. When we had an Alaskan who was lost and killed in Costa Rica, I called my counterparts in Arizona who worked with the National Guard in Costa Rica. And so the local to the national and even the international relationships are things that I think people should pay close attention to. I want to give a shout out for sports. In the Arctic, we've had something for a long time called Arctic Winter Games. And it includes Yamal. It includes Nunavut. It includes, we tried to get Iceland to join, Mr. President, and under your presidency, that's one of the things that we didn't accomplish. And it wasn't because Iceland didn't want to. It's because the coaches in the games didn't think they could do it. If they made it too big, they couldn't go to small communities. But I will tell you, the relationships from those sporting relationships, I know more Alaskans who have some understanding of the Arctic because they got to go to Arctic Winter Games. And that's very important. You talked about mothers and women. We could not have opened the border with Russia had it not been for a group called Alaska Performing Artists for Peace, which was the widow of somebody who had been whose husband had been killed in a plane crash, and she decided to take her insurance money and form a choir and go to Moscow. And Somehow Gorbachev's spokesman came back to visit her in Juneau a number of times, and that's how we got the border open between us. So I would recommend those things. The story with the military that I'll just close with, we were at the Wilson Center, and it was the beginning of the Trump administration, and I, as a state official, had worked with our Coast Guard to see if we could set up a vessel traffic system in the Bering Strait, because the Russians are bringing giant tankers through, and our seal hunters and our subsistence fishermen are in little boats. And they don't even have the AIS that the rector was talking about, that is so important to follow where a boat is. If it's over 100 million tons, there's a beacon. I can put you in touch with all of them. I sat on a panel like this, and I said the Russians haven't answered their mail. And after the panel, the Russian, the chief economic guy from the embassy came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "It's not us, it's you who haven't answered your mail." And I said, "You actually, what do you mean?" He said, "We invited the U.S. to come negotiate your idea of a vessel traffic system in the Bering Strait." And I said, "Well, send me the invitations, because," and I called the admiral, and I read him the invitation, and he had one word which is not appropriate to say at a panel like this. And within 8 months, during a time when everybody was suspicious of anything that could have happened between the United States and Russia because Donald Trump had just taken office, we actually put together this vessel traffic system, not only agreed to it between our two countries, but got it through the IMO. So we can save lives. And that's the value of continuing to work all levels of government with full respect. I get along with, I'm a Republican, I try to get along with Democrats, I try to get along with the Green Party, I try to get along with the Libertarians, a hard one, all because, you know, frankly, we're actually just trying to make our lives better. We've got sometimes different ways to do it. But if you can't talk, nothing happens.
Can I leave it to you? You've organized all of this.
Well, thank you. We have run out of time. I do want to beg your indulgence for about 30 more seconds, and I want to ask each panelist to leave the audience with one word or one concept that you have found in your deep experience to be critical to engaging in diplomacy or international affairs. I think each of you have demonstrated the importance of non-traditional actors playing in this space. And so I just ask you to think of, again, one word or maybe one concept that folks in the audience can take home with them and keep in their back pockets as they navigate these channels over the next couple of years. What do you have? Who wants to start? Asha?
I think if we have working together with each other, we need to partnership, collaboration is most important. Because still now we are facing so many sectors affected by climate and also many things. Because still now, developing country and underdeveloped country is very different problems. And then if you don't have knowledge and local people and underdeveloped countries, different type of organization, they can't achieve big thing. And then we need to collaboration, knowledge and scientific related resources and policy, budgeting also, collaborating with each other, local government to local government and local government to central government, local to private sector, central government to private sector, expert and scientists to private sector. That is the most thing. I think we need to collaboration and partnership is most important for the facing the these challenges. Thank you.
Thank you. Madeline?
I would say that you have to have passion. And as I think a word I used earlier was tenacity, and recognition that there's usually always someone who has authority to change a policy or to make a better and different decision. You just have to keep at it until you find it, a workaround, or, you know, convincing that this must be done, because there is so much sort of entrenchment, I find, you know, in bureaucracies and in governments, and you know, and you really just have to decide, I'm going to keep at it until we get, you know, what we need. But sometimes you need to also recognize that maybe you do have to be flexible in your approach. You get other people on board to sort of be part of that team and to sell it so that the people who actually are going to decide to do the right thing recognize it's a win, not for just yourself, but it's a win for them as well. So you need to find the way to get there, that path.
Okay, we heard collaboration, passion, tenacity, flexibility. David.
Yeah, very, very quickly, in the policy world, we often say that geography is the bones of strategy. But I heard another quote here today. Perseverance, and I think it was yesterday, somebody said, if you persevere, as you mentioned, that oftentimes strategy, or what you would say, culture eats strategy for breakfast. If you can change the culture, you can persevere and you'll make it.
Excellent. Thank you. Mead?
I have a friend who likes to say that's what jets are for. Many of us got here by sitting in an airplane seat for many, many hours, but I really treasure the fact that we came together in this part of the world to get one part of the world to know another part of the world. And there's nothing that beats face-to-face understanding. I had another friend who used to say, actually, he was the founder of the Channel Tunnel, and he was wrote a book on big projects, and he always said, big projects start with lunch.
That's great. Omer, any concluding insights or remarks?
I guess one thing that I'd say is all of these regions are incredibly beautiful. So, I mean, it might sound a little fluffy, but know why people love their places. And that's where the value comes in. That's where you share, that's where you build a kind of shared value system. Like, for example, going to a place like Tromsø, it's a beautiful city, right? I mean, it has this gorgeous library, which is from a former movie theater that's all lit up. And God, I just want to live there, right?
It's got a tunnel under a mountain that could hold the Chinese army.
Yeah, and I mean, or the food that you find in many of the mountain areas, right? Whether it's having Shinawari stuff in Kabul, or the bakeries across the mountain areas are fantastic. And these are, you know, if you travel through the roads of Bhutan, you know, you get to the Zong in the crossroads in the darkness. It is a fabulous experience of that silence and that space. These are what we are fighting to keep alive, that we have experienced in our lifetime, that we want to pass on to our next generation. Hey, you also want to do this, right? You want to see a tiger in the wild, right? Or as long as it's not behind you. But I don't think I think we get embarrassed by saying how much we love our lands. And I think we have to overcome that and say, actually, no, this is gorgeous. And hey, do you want to sit and have the shared meal, have that lunch? And that's how the projects begin.
Well, thank you. I have again, so much gratitude to President Grimson for allowing us to organize this panel. So much gratitude to just outstanding panelists. Thank you so much. Let's give them a round of applause. Thank you.